They said it wasn't Jesus who was crucified, but Simon of Cyrene. The Roman soldiers forced Simon to carry Jesus' cross. The next sentence in the Gospel of Mark says that they crucified him. But who is the him? Jesus or Simon? The subject isn't clear. According to a later tradition ascribed to Vasilides, Jesus transformed his body to appear as Simon, and transformed Simon's body to appear as Jesus. As the soldiers then crucified Simon, Jesus laughed at their foolishness. This is one of the many odd traditions ascribed to Vasilides, a Christian theologian from Alexandria, who lived in the early 2nd century of our era. Other traditions say that Vasilides was the first to derive the theory of creation from nothing. He was the first to call God himself nothing, making him the first Christian atheist. Initiates in Vasilides' circle, we are told, had to persevere in a 5-year silence, like the disciples of Pythagoras. Reportedly, Vasilides believed in 365 heavens, new angelic names like Abrasax, and was the first to determine the date of Christmas and Easter. What are the sources of these traditions, and are any of them actually true? In this session, I'll introduce you to the sources and story of Vasilides, a contemporary of Valentinus, a fellow Alexandrian, and a profound but generally forgotten theologian. People call him a Gnostic, but of course he was a Christian as well. He lived before the days when Christianity was invented, and he played a role in its invention. I'm Dr. David Litwa, and it's my joy to provide free content on this channel. To do this, however, I depend entirely on your support. So please consider supporting me on Patreon, making a one-time donation, or by taking one of my many courses on early Christian figures like Marcion, Valentinus, and on topics such as redating the Gospels. Eventually, all my courses will be available to you on a single subscription called the Gnosis Academy, and being part of this academy involves a monthly hangout with me. So join and introduce yourself to me personally. Links are in the description. Bentley Layton calls him the first Christian philosopher and one of the earliest New Testament expositors, a predecessor figure whose significance was combated and eventually repressed by Orthodox memory. Jean-Daniel Dubois names him the first Christian intellectual known in the history of the Egyptian church. He is indeed the first named Christian theologian who lived and taught in Alexandria, Egypt. Clement of Alexandria dated him to the reigns of Hadrian and Antoninus Pius. Vasilides was thus a contemporary of Valentinus, Carpocrates, Polycarp, and Papias. When Vasilides died is unknown, but he was perhaps slightly younger than Marcion, who perished about 160. Epiphanius observed that Vasilides taught in other smaller cities of the Nile Delta. Either this report is based on local tradition, or Epiphanius assumed that Vasilides must have taught where there were surviving Vasilidean groups in the 4th century. Whether Vasilides traveled outside of Egypt is unknown. Attempts to place his origins in Syria or to grant him a Syrian sojourn are based in part on the effort to connect his thought to Saturninus, a putative fellow student of Menander of Antioch. This connection to Saturninus, made by Irenaeus, is based on presumed intellectual overlaps. Such presumptions cannot be allowed to stand, however, since Vasilides' disagreements with Saturninus are also manifold and deep. According to surviving evidence, for example, Vasilides did not discourage marriage and childbearing, he did not affirm the divine spark within humanity, and he had no story of humanity created in the image of God. Indeed, we have no surviving fragments in which Vasilides interpreted Genesis 1-6 at all. Vasilides was unfamiliar with exactly seven creator angels, and he never discouraged the consumption of meat. These are all significant differences. I thus think it's hasty to connect Vasilides and Saturninus in a kind of intellectual genealogy. What we know is that Vasilides was a prolific author. He wrote a long work in 24 books called the Exegetica, or Interpretations. It seems to have commented in part on an early version of the Gospel according to Luke. It's probably a false report that Vasilides composed his own Gospel. Later Vasilideans depended on a work ascribed to Matthias. Interestingly, quotes from a work called Traditions of Matthias survive, but they present no obvious connection to Vasilides' teaching. Vasilides had a son and a disciple named Isidore. In fact, Isidore is the only named disciple of Vasilides. Isidore wrote at least three works, the first called The Excrescent Soul, a work called Ethics, and finally, The Interpretations of the Prophet Parkhor. We have no idea who Parkhor is, but he seems to be a prophet from the East. Vasilides mentioned other prophets with Aramaic-sounding names, like Bar-Kabbas and Bar-Kof. When Clement reports the views of Vasilideans, he seems to be thinking primarily of Isidore. Indeed, we have more quotes from Isidore than we do from Vasilides, his father. Thus, what is often reported as the thought of Vasilides may well be the views of Isidore, or perhaps another of Vasilides' disciples. There are three main sources for the thought of Vasilides: the report of Irenaeus, the report of the anonymous author of The Refutation of All Heresies, whom I call the Refutator, and the genuine fragments, mostly quoted by Clement of Alexandria in his Stromata. These sources conflict with each other in many points. They probably stem from different figures or books which existed at different times. This means that we cannot simply mix these materials and synthesize them. And we can't ascribe then the synthesized teachings to Vasilides himself. Just as we do in gospel studies, we must separate out all the sources to discern the distinctive message of each. And in literature and online, the report of Irenaeus on Vasilides typically gets unfair preferential treatment. It is the easiest to read, I think, and it seems to be confirmed by later reports, but of course these later reports simply copy and rephrase Irenaeus, so they are not independent. At any rate, Irenaeus' views on Vasilides, or as AI calls him, Vasilides, dominate not only Wikipedia and YouTube, but even published dictionaries and encyclopedias. This is problematic in my view, because some of what Irenaeus says contradicts the authentic fragments of Vasilides, and Irenaeus may have depended on sources written after Vasilides died. The report of the Refutator is not well known, and it's frankly very complex. It's found in Book 7 of the Refutation of All Heresies, and it's attached to an interesting but ultimately unpersuasive comparison of Vasilides and Aristotle. According to this report, the world emerged from a seed produced by a non-existent god, and from the seed derived three sonships. The point of salvation is for these sonships to be restored to fellowship with the divine. Finally, we have the genuine fragments of Vasilides and Isidore quoted by Clement. In approaching Vasilides, I think we need to prioritize these genuine fragments before discussing the secondary reports of Irenaeus and the Refutator. So this is my procedure here and in my forthcoming courses on Vasilides as well as my book. Why would we prioritize the fragments of Clement? Well, the most obvious reason is that they give us the actual words of Vasilides and Isidore as opposed to anonymous secondary reports. Bentley Layton supplies some other reasons for prioritizing Clement. Clement, he says, belongs to the next generation or two after Vasilides. He writes from Vasilides' own city of Alexandria. He shares with him the profession of Christian philosophy of religion, and he is tolerant and interested in his rival's opinions, as well as displaying a nice antiquarian bent. Back in 1996, the German scholar Winrich Luhr argued that there were 19 fragments of Vasilides and Isidore. He put them in the order in which Clement presented them in the Stromata. Then Luhr added a fragment from the excerpts from Theodotus, two fragments from Origen, and a fragment from the Acts of Archelaus, ascribed to Hegemonius. The fragments deal with a range of concepts. There are, for instance, three fragments describing and defining Christian faith, three fragments on transmigration, three fragments in a discussion of martyrdom, a long fragment on Persian cosmogony, a fragment on dating Christ's incarnation and crucifixion. There are also fragments on forgiveness, sexuality, prophecy, the passions, ethics, and the Ogduid. All the fragments are interesting in their own right, and I talk about them in my course and book on Vasilides. The overwhelming temptation is to read the fragments in light of Irenaeus and the Refutator, but these sorts of synthetic readings are often premature. We must first prioritize the genuine fragments, the actual words of Vasilides and Isidore, and then use them to fact-check the later heresiological reports. Irenaeus and the Refutator can never trump the fragments, and they cannot serve as a framework for them. Instead, we must work hard to read the fragments, form a picture of Vasilidean thought, and then use that framework to read the heresy hunters. At the end of this exercise, we will then be ready for a synthetic and critical reading of the combined sources. Now, in this session, I can't explain to you all the fragments. For that, you must take my course on Vasilides and read my book. But I can give you just a foretaste of a fragment to whet your appetite. Fragment 6 from Clement's Stromata, Book 3, reads as follows, quote, "The followers of Vasilides say that when the apostles asked if it were better not to marry, the Lord responded, 'Not all can accept this teaching, for there are eunuchs from birth and those from necessity.' They explain this saying as follows, quote, 'Some have a natural aversion to women from birth, and by following their natural temperament, they rightly do not marry. These are the eunuchs from birth. The eunuchs by compulsion are the theatrical ascetics who control themselves on account of the counter-impulse of glory. Those who have suffered the misfortune of castration have also become eunuchs by compulsion. It follows that those who are eunuchs by compulsion aren't eunuchs for any rational cause, but those who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the eternal kingdom, due to the circumstances which arise from marriage, these people use rational reflection, they say, since they fear lack of time caused by providing necessities. And with regard to the phrase, better to marry than to burn, the apostle means don't throw your soul into fire, resisting night and day and fearing that you might fall from self-control. For when the soul meets with this struggle, it is cut off from its hope. So resist, Isidore says verbatim in his Ethics, the combative woman, so that you aren't dragged from God's grace. After ejaculating the fire, pray with a good conscience. When your thanksgiving slips into supplication, and you in the end ask not to act correctly, but simply not to fall, then get married. But a man who is young, poor, or prone to vice, who does not want to marry according to reason, let him not separate from his brother. Let him say, I have come to the holy things. I cannot suffer anything. But if he has suspicion about himself, let him say, Brother, lay your hand on me that I not sin. And he will receive help both intelligible and perceptible. Only let him want to prepare the good, and he will find it. Sometimes we say with the mouth, we don't want to sin, but our mind is disposed to sin. Such a person does not do what he wants due to fear, so that punishment is not meted out for him. Humanity has certain necessary and physical desires. Others are only physical. Clothing oneself is necessary and natural. Sexual pleasures are natural, but not necessary. Now, this fragment, I think, probably comes entirely from Isidore's Ethics, although Clement only cites this work midway through the quotation. The Ethics evidently dealt with moral problems faced by the Christian. They are, or give an example of, early Christian pastoral care. The fragment underscores that Christian philosophy was a way of life, an ethical path. The fragment contains Isidore's interpretation of what is now Matthew 19, verses 11 to 12, and it shows that Vasilideans treated a version of the Matthean wave as an authoritative writing. The verses from Matthew are initially paraphrased and shortened by either Isidore or Clement. Eunuchs from the womb of the mother are shortened to eunuchs from birth. These men are said to be basically asexual, manifesting an aversion to women. Eunuchs made eunuchs by people in Matthew become eunuchs from necessity. These include literal eunuchs, who were mostly male slaves castrated in boyhood for various purposes. On the metaphorical level, this class also includes theatrical ascetics, people who are sexually continent to draw attention to themselves. Such people are governed by the inward necessity of selfishness and fame. The third category of self-made eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven is initially omitted, but in the comments they are referred to as eunuchs for the sake of the eternal kingdom. These are the people who take Paul's advice in 1 Corinthians 7, 28-35. They seek to live without distraction, and the greatest distraction is the need to provide for a wife and children in these troubled times. So their decision is informed by fear of not being able to provide, but Isidore emphasizes their rational reflection. These are the only rational eunuchs. The rational eunuch is not actually physically castrated. Isidore is not recommending medical castration to prevent sexual desire. He argued for the use of rational reflection to control sexual desire. And this is important because we know that sometime between 150 and 154, a young Alexandrian Christian actually did petition the governor, Munatius Felix, to have his testicles removed by doctors. And he needed permission because of Rome's anti-castration laws. This young man didn't simply send a petition. He sent Felix a small tract laying out the logic for his castration. And when the governor refused, the young man, along with those of like mind, lived the life of eunuchs with their testicles intact. If they couldn't reshape their bodies, they could still transform their minds to attain a sexless ideal. Apparently, this attempted castrator belonged to a wider circle of celibate Christians in Alexandria. We know nothing else about him. From Isidore's comments, we can determine that Isidore himself was a moderate ascetic, a Pauline type of ascetic, who believed that the best Christian life need not involve the creation of a family. We might infer that Isidore himself was one of these self-made eunuchs for the eternal kingdom. The fact that Isidore was thinking of 1 Corinthians 7 is indicated by his later citation of 7 verse 9, that is, better to marry than to burn. Isidore emphasized virtually the same point that Paul did. If people, young men specifically, can't be self-controlled, let them marry. Both Paul and Isidore thought of marriage as a medicine for lust, lust being likened to an internal fire. What they were apparently trying to prevent was men deflowering women out of wedlock. Isidore was also trying to prevent the constant internal struggle, which separates people from their hope, apparently their hope of transcending the body and its urges. Then Isidore's exhortation takes an interesting turn. He exhorts men to endure or to struggle against a combative woman so that you are not dragged from God's grace. Who is this combative woman? The language comes from Proverbs 21:19 in the Septuagint. Quote, "It's better to dwell in a desert land than with a woman who is combative, garrulous, and irascible." Unquote. The combative woman could, of course, be literal. Could be a shrewish wife, but in context, Isidore seems to be speaking to unmarried men. Thus, I understand the combative woman as metaphorical, and specifically as referring to lust. Lust could be personified as a female, and as Aphrodite in particular. And Aphrodite could be imperious, as we see her in the Iliad, Book 3. In one particular scene, Aphrodite appears to Helen as an old Spartan woman. At first she coaxes and then commands Helen to go to Paris, aka Alexander, and have sex with him in an upper chamber. Now one can learn to resist or to endure Aphrodite, and one can do so by the grace or gift of God. Perhaps the gift of God is ejaculation itself. One ejaculates the fire, Isidore says. Apparently this fire is a reference to semen associated with the hot and fiery nature of pneuma. It's not a sin to ejaculate, according to Isidore, for afterward one can pray with a good conscience. But how exactly does one ejaculate? Was Isidore talking about wet dreams or masturbation or some other means? He doesn't specify. It's all a bit coy. I suspect that masturbation is at least included as a means to dampen the raging force and to remove oneself from fire, or to remove the fire itself. If I'm correct, this would actually be the first Christian discussion of masturbation, and it's essentially positive. As Isidore clarifies at the end of the fragment, sexual desire is entirely natural. Perhaps he thought that God gave a natural gift to exhaust this desire, a release valve, as it were. The end goal, of course, is not to awaken and feed sexual desire, but to dampen and even to destroy it. Isidore explains the order of prayer. It begins with thanksgiving and then proceeds to petition. What he seems to be saying is that if one finds oneself asking God simply not to fall into sexual sin, then one should marry. The point of life is to do what is right. If one spends most of one's time struggling with sexual temptation, then marriage is a good solution. It's not the best form of Christian life, but it is better than falling into sexual sin and into constant temptation. Isidore then deals with objections. What if one is too young or too poor or too prone to vice to make a rational decision to marry possible? In that case, one is to seek the companionship or fellowship of a Christian brother. Does this assume some sort of monastic arrangement, Christian brothers living together? Evidently. But it's a long time before formal monasticism. At any rate, these Christian Basilidean brothers imagine themselves as entering into holy things, which might mean intelligible and sacred mysteries or truths. In this context of learning, one could keep one's mind away from disturbing desires. But if a brother doubted himself, he could ask another brother to, quote, lay your hand on me that I not sin, unquote. This could simply be a hand of comfort or support for the person undergoing temptation. In context, however, the hand could also be a fondling hand. The help that the brother gives is both intelligible and sensible, that is, physical. The physical help may involve masturbation with the help of another. Isidore does not recommend full-on intercourse with a member of the same sex. He simply advises that help be given to a brother struggling with sexual temptation, and the rest is up for interpretation. The intent of both brothers must be to prepare something good. In context, something good would be healing from lust and a return to the higher consciousness, or the consciousness that contemplates higher intelligible things. The final comment seems to be dealing with potentially hypocritical brothers who confess their will not to sin, but who nevertheless have a mental disposition to sin. Such a person must be deterred by fear of punishment. Again, the end goal is to arrive at a place where one does not have a desire for sex. Sexual desire is natural but not necessary. Epicurus had divided pleasures into three categories: natural and necessary, natural but not necessary, and neither natural nor necessary. To Isidore, at least, wearing clothes is both natural and necessary, but sex, although natural, is not necessary. Sexual desire is incredibly powerful and strongly rooted in our biology. Nevertheless, one can live a fully human life without sex, and this is a reasonable goal for a Christian to have. One should never unnecessarily excite sexual desire, but should aim to live without it. Now, all of this teaching from Isidore might not be the Basilidean teaching you are familiar with. Perhaps you were expecting some raging libertines in wild parties, but as in most things regarding Gnosis and Gnosticism, there's a finely tuned mix of liberty and strictness in this passage. The fact that most people are simply unfamiliar with it just goes to show that popular AI sorts of sources for information about Basilides tend to be ignorant of what actual Basilideans said. Now, I've spent considerable time researching for this presentation, and if you've enjoyed it, I hope you'll consider taking my course on Basilides. As I begin to build it out, the course will be priced very low, and that price will gradually increase as the course becomes more and more complete. So I urge everybody here to take advantage. Be sure to watch my other videos and take my courses on other figures, such as Valentinus, Marcion, and others, if you're interested in learning about the other side of early Christianity.